From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio left dozens dead this weekend, and there were multiple mass shootings last weekend. One at the Gilroy Garlic Festival in California garnered days of national coverage. Another at the Brownsville Old Timers Day block party in Brooklyn barely registered. These tragedies have become an all too frequent part of the news, forcing those of us in the media to wrestle with the fact that what we choose to cover and how we choose to cover it shapes public perceptions of these events and may even influence whether or not they continue to happen. Jason Silva is an assistant professor at William Patterson University, where he studies media coverage of mass shootings. He's analyzed 50 years of New York Times articles. Full disclosure, I spoke with Jason on Wednesday before this weekend's tragic events. Jason, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Was there one particular event that originally got you interested in studying mass shootings and how they are covered by the mass media?
Well, I would say that, like most people of my generation, I was sort of introduced to mass shootings via Columbine, which to this day has received more media coverage than any other shooting and has sort of become representative of the type of instances that are covered. So I would say that that is sort of set the precedence for my interest, especially in present day.
Your doctoral thesis work was this analysis of 50 years of shootings and the media coverage of them, specifically in the New York Times. But I'm curious how you even compiled that data. I mean, my understanding is there are multiple databases of mass shootings, but there is no one comprehensive authoritative database of mass shootings.
Right. So that's one of the big issues that we have. The FBI doesn't necessarily have a mass shooting definition. They have this mass killing definition. All of their reports are about active shooters, which doesn't necessarily care about how many people were killed or injured, which has its own positives. But as we're trying to accumulate these mass shooting databases, we often think about primarily the motivation and the number of victims that are killed. So with the Gilroy shooting, that would be considered a mass shooting because three people were killed, which is normally the cutoff point. Some people use four. And it seems that he did not have any sort of gang-related or crime-related or state-sponsored motivations, as opposed to when you look at something like you brought up the Brooklyn shooting, that was motivated, we believe, by some sort of gang dispute, and then this would therefore not be considered a mass shooting in many of the definitions.
So when you look at the data that you have amassed over 50 years of shootings, what are some of the commonalities or trends that you tend to see?
I think one thing that we need to bring up is that it's overwhelmingly male. And this is something that's been predominantly neglected, and we've been looking at recently this idea of toxic masculinity and aggressive men and what is motivating them to do this.
So when you say it's overwhelmingly male, you mean the shooters are overwhelmingly men?
The shooters are overwhelmingly male, yes. And this has sort of received more attention in the aftermath of like the incel movement that's gotten a lot of attention and the shooting at Isla Vista, California, the member of the incel movement. When we think about the incidences themselves, we find that a lot of coverage is dedicated to school shooters and a lot is dedicated to ideologically motivated perpetrators. However, with my research, we're finding that the reality is it's actually more often occurring in the workplace or in these sort of open spaces, as was the case with the Gilroy shooting.
So, Jason Silva, your interest is in how the media covers it. And you've already noted, right, that certain types of shootings have tended to get more coverage than others. Your analysis looked specifically at the New York Times. And I wonder how representative you think that is in our increasingly fractured media landscape. There's a lot of diversity in what is covered and how it's covered.
Sure. So that's been one of the issues, right? How do we sort of change media analyses over this changing landscape? But we still find that the New York Times is representative of general media at large. So when we look at, for example, what's highlighted in Twitter, we're oftentimes seeing people drawing from information that was originally obtained from the New York Times. So similar to historically, we found that other newspapers were drawing their information that aligned not necessarily with the ideologies of what the New York Times represents, but more just the amount of coverage dedicated to a certain subject matter. So we're finding the same thing right now, right? One of the issues that we were suggesting is that the Gilroy shooting is receiving a lot more coverage than perhaps the Brooklyn shooting. Now, we're not saying anything about the information within these different media outlets, right? But we're finding the same amount of attention is dedicated either in the New York Times or in a more conservative news source.
And if you look across mass media as a whole, you've already mentioned that different types of shootings tend to garner more coverage. But if we look overall, what fraction of mass shootings get covered, period?
We find that about 75% of mass shootings get covered, but there's a huge difference in the amount of coverage. See, average shooting only receives about 4 or 5 New York Times articles. And then there's these few high-profile events that receive extensive, enormous levels of coverage. So in our research, we found that Columbine, for example, the most covered one, has received over 500 articles at this point. So this is sort of what's setting the American mindset and our framework for what represents a mass shooting. It's these few high-profile instances, and what we determine are these high-profile instances.
And Jason Silva, you have called your analysis a media distortion analysis. What is it that you think media coverage is distorting relative to the reality of mass shooting events?
So I did not invent the media distortion analysis. This is something that I had taken from colleagues, Stephen Shermock and Jeff Gruenwald, and they sort of framed it as this idea that, all right, let's highlight the reality of all these instances, and then we'll highlight, and then we'll examine the media coverage of all these instances, and we'll do a comparison. And with my research over the 50-year timeline, we found that we are dedicating a lot more coverage to school and lone wolf ideologies when the reality is that they occur in the workplace and in open spaces much more. We're also dedicating an enormous amount of coverage to rifles and these automatic, semi-automatic weapons. Now, the reality is, in fact, in mass shootings, handguns are actually used much more often. While they may not necessarily
really
be as deadly, we're looking into that right now. Actually, we have a piece that'll be coming out shortly on that. And that's sort of representative of gun violence at large. So what we also need to consider in this media distortion is that mass shootings are really only representative of the gun violence problem, but they make up a small minority of the gun violence problem, right? Like 1% of gun violence instances, they're predominantly using handguns. 90% of crime uses handguns. So we need to think about how, yes, it's important to perhaps implement gun control strategies if this is the way that you want to take it, surrounding AK-47s and these, you know, semi-automatic, automatic weapons. However, this also may be, to a degree, a form of symbolic legislation that would not necessarily prevent gun violence at large in the United States.
Jason Silva, one issue that those of us in the media have certainly been wrestling with in recent months and recent years is how much information to share about the perpetrators of these crimes. And we saw after the New Zealand mosque shooting, the Prime Minister of New Zealand call for news outlets not to say the shooter's name. And in fact, a new analysis has found that only about 14% of media coverage in the United States actually did release that shooter's name. In the past week, it seems to be really variable from outlet to outlet how the shooter's identity and ideology is treated. Do you feel like we're seeing changes in media attention to the shooter and also to the victims involved?
I would say this has been a huge step forward. So we in academia have been talking about this for quite a few years now. And in my research, we really sort of promoted this idea of the no notoriety campaign, as it's been oftentimes referred to, right? Let's not give the shooters attention. Let's not put their names more than once within these news sources. Let's not put their pictures on the front page. And we've actually noticed a dramatic change in the coverage of these shooters. So that's very exciting for us as academics, where oftentimes we kind of feel like we introduce this research and we have these findings and then sort of nothing happens with them. To actually see this sort of occurring is rather exciting. And you're absolutely right. I would say that the New Zealand shooting was representative of that on a global scale. However, I think it's also important to credit Parkland, who have been very vocal in terms of no notoriety and have been able to garner a lot more attention than perhaps some of the more previous mass shootings. So I think that we're seeing a tremendous change in attention to these perhaps fame-seeking shooters. So this has been very successful. But at the same time, we're still dedicating enormous amounts of attention to these mass shootings, which, as I keep noting, is not necessarily representative of gun violence at large. So if we look at something like the Brooklyn shooting, that's receiving very limited coverage and, in fact, is more representative of gun violence and perhaps the type of legislation we should be implementing to prevent gun violence in the United States.
Which comes back to this idea of media distortion, but also even at the research level, if shootings that involve gang affiliations are not even included in the databases as mass shootings, if they are not covered as mass shootings, it gives them less weight in the public eye, and that would seem to be a mistake.
Absolutely. And I think places like the Gun Violence Archive, they don't consider motivation. They just consider whether or not four or more people are killed. So that has its own value. However, with things like the mass shooting database that I work on, the reason we don't include gang violence is because a lot of times those motivations are so drastically different. The precipitating crisis events are so drastically different. And therefore, the prevention strategies are so drastically different.
And of course, there's an inherent inequality in reporting on one and not another, because the image of mass shootings, as we've come to think of them, is overwhelmingly white, whereas the gang-related mass shootings are often people of color.
Right. So, and that goes back to a long line of media research, which has found that we're dedicating a lot less coverage to sort of this black-on-black crime, because in the social construction of criminality in the United States, that's considered common and not worthy of consideration, whereas we want this sort of sensational coverage to draw the public eye, and that's sort of where the mass shootings come into play. So yes, it's receiving a lot of coverage, and I think that coverage can be useful because I think that we can use it to say we have a gun violence problem, now let's enact legislation, but we need to make sure that that legislation addresses the gun violence problem at large and not just these few high-profile instances.
Jason Silva, based on your body of research, are there recommendations that you would make both to mass media for coverage of shootings and also to media consumers for, you know, how to handle or what kind of coverage to look for?
I think the current media is doing a great job with the No Notoriety campaign. So first of all, I would like to commend them on that. I think that's been a huge step forward. But I also think that within coverage reporting, even if you're dedicating an enormous amount of attention because it's drawing the eyeballs, so for example, with the Gilroy shooting, people are interested, so it's gaining a lot of attention. Within that coverage, I think it's important to note a few of these key factors that I've highlighted. So to say, yes, we're dedicating coverage to Gilroy, but this is not representative of gun violence at large, we should also take into consideration these other things. So you can use this platform of sensational coverage for creating insight into these alternative gun violence issues.
Jason Silva is assistant professor at William Patterson University. He studies trends in media coverage of mass shootings. Jason, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Massachusetts legislators this past week called on their federal colleagues to pass the Scientific Assistance for the Very Endangered Right Whales Act, also known as the Save Right Whales Act. It's a bill that was introduced earlier this year to fund the development of technologies that could help avoid ship strikes and fishing gear entanglements that are killing North Atlantic right whales at a rate researchers say could drive the species extinct in a matter of decades. There are only about 400 of the whales remaining, and 8 have died this summer in Canadian waters where they're congregated. That has prompted government officials there to declare new funding for almost a dozen different research projects that they hope could lead to solutions. One is a new type of whale detection system that uses thermal imaging, and it's being developed by Dan Zitterbart of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thermal infrared imaging, how does this actually work, and how might it be used to find whales?
It is basically like a camera, but instead of imaging light in the visual wavelengths, it images light in the thermal wavelengths.
I mean, this is presumably like those images we sometimes see, the heat images where you can kind of see the outline of a person on maybe a security camera or something like that.
Specifically, that's it.
Yeah.
And what we are exploiting here is the apparent temperature contrast between the background, which is the ocean, and the whale spout itself. When the whale comes to the surface, you know, it needs to breathe. That's why it comes to the surface. And then it blows. Very characteristic whale blow can be picked up in thermal infrared cameras as a warm feature compared to the background.
So you're not actually looking for the whale's body itself, but just that warm air and water, that puff of
yes.
warm air and water. That
basically, that's what we're doing. For. We can see the body. So it's not that it's impossible if the whale breaches, for example. That's a wonderful signal. But of course, that happens much less. And if the whale comes to the surface and just, you know, skims it, basically, the portion of the body you see is very small. So you don't want to rely on this. The body is actually the least reliable cue of all the cues we can detect.
Whale blows have been used for hundreds of years to find whales. I mean, there she blows, right? That's the way whalers used to sight a whale like out on the horizon. But how far away could a camera like this see a whale blow? Would it actually, you know, give you longer range detection of whales than just visual sighting?
This depends. Very simple, like everything, it depends. So we are not looking for that. You could, and we detected whale blows, let's say, in 5, 6, 7 miles distance.
Wow, that's
but,
really far away.
That's actually not our aim. The aim here is to have sensible range, but be very specific on just detecting this. Because the ship in the ship strike case doesn't need to know in 5 kilometers there will be a whale. You know, that will be gone, long gone. Like a kilometer two is the aim range we have. Because you want to make sure that you're good enough to detect almost all of them in that. So more important is actually the detection probability rather than the maximum distance.
Right. So you want to be able to find whales that are in a range where you might actually hit them, but conversely, you might actually be able to avoid them.
Exactly.
If you were to put cameras like this presumably on ships, does somebody need to be watching this all the time? Or are we talking about kind of another radar screen where you're going to have a screen that's going to pop up? Oh, look, there's a whale over there, or an alarm goes off when you see a spout somewhere.
So, of course, when we started to develop this technology, there was somebody looking at the screen just to see if it's, as a proof of concept, if it's possible or not. But we showed since about 5 years now that it actually works. It just depends on which hardware do you use. And we developed algorithms where the aim is the algorithm scans through all the imagery that comes continuously. And when it classifies object and when it thinks, oh, there might be a whale, it actually presents a tiny little snippet to a person. And then people can say, yes, it's a whale. Oh, no, that was a false positive. You know, the algorithm took the bird to be a whale. If you have like a bird on the surface and it starts flying, it can
that
look very
look
much
a
like a
bit.
Whale blow.
Dan Zitterbart, you just said that you've, you know, had validated this like 5 years ago. Why is this then a target for funding and development now? I mean, why isn't this a standard feature on ships?
So the hardware we used 5 years ago was very bulky and very expensive. And basically, there was no possibility to put this on a big number of vessels. That wouldn't have worked. We need to get the hardware much smaller, way more cost effective, and improve on the amount of false positives.
How long would that kind of development take? I mean, it sounds like this technology is maybe not off the shelf, but is quite well developed already at this point.
So I aim to have a working prototype by the end of next year, or by next summer we are going on the water. And then I aim to go on the first ferry prototype. So we go on with a commercial vessel, basically by the end of next year and the year after. And just because there is a big difference if, you know, an expert is on board, I'm on board, I still can fiddle with something. I, you know, can change settings and stuff, and having a system that you give off to somebody and it runs on itself without supervision, there's a lot of steps in between those two things. So we are still at the prototype stage here. But because our aim is actually, I mean, as scientists, our aim is not the commercialization of such a product in the end. The aim is to do the proper characterization and see what are the limits and what do we actually need to make it happen. That is my question here.
There are other ways to detect a whale that is in front of or around a ship. Here near Boston, we have essentially microphones picking up the sounds that whales make that can send a signal to ships and say, there are whales in the area, you should slow down. Or you could actually have a person on board looking for when whales come to the surface. What's the advantage of a system like this with a camera specifically looking for this heat signature?
There's two major advantages. One is the availability bias. That means that for a hydrophone to detect a whale, it needs to make a sound. It does not necessarily always make a sound. You know, there is stretches of days where whales just are silent. But they always have to go breathe. Every hour at least, but for the baleen whales, usually every couple of minutes, 10 to 20 minutes, they come to the surface and breathe. So you can be sure the whale will be at the surface at a given point and will be available to be detected.
That's also, of course, when it's at the greatest risk of being hit by a ship.
Exactly. And the second one is it works at night. So your human observer doesn't work at night. Human observers are great. Okay, if we ever can get better than a human observer during the day, that's a real challenge because our brain is just an amazing tool to detect stuff. We see these anomalies. I worked with marine mammal observers and you are on the bridge with them and you know they talk to you. They don't even appear to be looking and then at some point, oh, there's a whale. And they you know, you were like, wait, what do you see? Yeah, there was a blow there, like in 4 kilometers distance.
And 4 kilometers it's off to the right, you
exactly,
know, at the edge of your vision.
It's amazing. So the field of view a human gets and the precision you have is really good. And if we ever achieve that during the day, it would be amazing. But the human observer doesn't work at night and the computer doesn't get tired. These are the two really good things on having a machine.
How much of the problem with whales being hit by ships is knowing that the whale is there? And how much is ships' captains feeling like their hands are tied? Even if they know there's a whale in front of them, they don't have a lot of options or a lot of room to maneuver to avoid that strike.
I think that depends very much on where you look. Which species and which vessels. You know, if you look at ferries, like fast ferries in the Canary Islands, they have a massive problem with ship strike of sperm whales. But they can maneuver. They are pretty maneuverable ships. They can slow down pretty quickly. If you, of course, talk about a supertanker, that's a different scale of problem. And that's nothing I think we can tackle with this technology. So we are really aiming what I would call high-risk vessels that go through areas with a lot of whales very often, that go pretty fast, but still are maneuverable. I think that's the class of vessels this technology can be useful for. For the big ships, I think just slowing them down when you know that a lot of whales are around is crucial. And there, this technology could help in a different way, because if you equip the other vessels that go through this area constantly, like ferries, with this technology, they can build a map. Where are the whales right now? You know, they can get a pretty good... Where are the hot spots? And so you could do something like dynamic management and basically make speed restrictions being more mobile.
The other question is, whale by whale, but...
No, not whale by whale,
hour
but day
hour
by
day or
hour
by
hour, yes.
I mean, I guess that's what I was kind of wondering is how big a piece of the pie when we look at all of the things that might be necessary to reduce the rate of deaths, in this case, particularly of North Atlantic right whales, because they're critically endangered and we've seen such high death rates, but whales across the board. I mean, how important is this one technology?
Honestly, for the North Atlantic right whale, it also doesn't even matter because everyone we don't kill is very important. You know, there's so few left, especially with only the 100 females left, or what we estimate. Every one of those dramatically reduces the survival rate of the species. So if we can get a piece of the pie with all the different technologies that are out there, I think that's the best we can do.
Basically, it's time to throw everything we've got at this problem.
I totally agree.
Dan Zitterbart is an assistant scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, helping to develop thermal infrared imaging for whale detection. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Yeah. take my horse through the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more.
Old Town Road. Lil Nas X's country western rap hit is now not only genre-breaking, it's record-breaking. It has held Billboard's number one spot for 17 weeks, breaking the record previously set by the 2017 hit Despacito and, back in the mid-90s, One Sweet Day by Mariah Carey and Boyz II Men. Well, what propels a song to that kind of popularity? In the case of Old Town Road, it may be the unexpected juxtaposition of rap style and lyrics about horses. Jonah Berger is Associate Professor of Marketing at University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School and author of Contagious, Why Things Catch On. Jonah, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jonah, you published a study last year about what makes songs in particular become so popular. And you found that songs that fall outside the norms of a given genre are the ones that become most popular. I mean, that certainly seems to describe Old Town Road.
Definitely. So, you know, my collaborator, Grant Packard, and I were interested in why do some songs become hits? We see this all the time. What about them, though, makes them a hit? And Old Town Road certainly is different than what we might expect.
This is kind of a high-risk, high-reward strategy. I mean, if you're going outside the norms of your genre, there's the chance that it'll be a complete flop. Is there any sweet spot for being just far enough outside of a genre to become popular?
That's a nice point. And, you know, one interesting question is, what makes a song inside a genre? And there are certain features of songs that really locate them within genres, but there are also some features of songs that allow us to go outside genres. And one thing we think is that the musical features, you know, the guitar and the other aspects of the song, really locate it within country. It sounds a lot like country. The topic, horses, sits it within country. But some of the other features mix it with a little more hip-hop, and that's what makes it atypical.
Let's hear a little bit more of Old Town Road.
I got the horses in the back, horse stock is attached, head is matted black, got the bushes black to match, riding on a horse, ha, you can whip your Porsche, I've been in the valley, you ain't been up off that porch, now can't nobody tell.
I mean, that perfectly illustrates what you were just talking about. You don't expect necessarily a rap song like that to be talking about horses. It's pretty unexpected, and the whole song keeps you guessing, at least for me. I mean, it's kind of surprising and amusing and intriguing all the way along, no matter how many times I hear it. Is this serious? Is this parody? Are those rhymes brilliant or completely ridiculous? You're constantly intrigued by the song.
Yeah, there's this great term in psychology called optimal distinctiveness. And it's all about things that are sort of similar and different at the same time. And it's mostly applied to the idea of identity being, you know, similar to groups and different from others at the same time. But you can think about the same thing within, say, a cultural item. You know, similarity is good because it makes things easier to process. It makes them familiar. If a song is completely different from something we've ever heard before, it's not going to be really easy to listen to, right? If it was, you know, banging on a wall plus, you know, some scratching sounds plus words that made no sense, we wouldn't want to listen to it, right? It'd be too
different.
That's what
my kids do on a regular
before.
Basis.
Their music is wonderful, I'm sure. And so there's some benefits to familiarity, right? There's some benefits to sounding like things we've heard before. At the same time, if something's exactly the same as what we've heard before, it's not going to get any attention. There's nothing new about it. And so there's this nice blend of novelty and familiarity, of similarity and difference, of new and old. You can almost think about it as a Goldilocks effect, right? Not too hot, not too cold, but just right. That really helps things in culture succeed. We did another paper a few years ago. We looked at baby names, and we found that baby names are more successful, again, when they're kind of similar and different, when they have some sounds that have been popular in other baby names recently, but are different in some names as well. And so that mix of familiarity and difference really helps drive success.
Jonah Berger, I want to go back to the aspects of Old Town Road that you were describing that might locate it within the rap genre versus locating it within the country western genre, because, of course, this song has actually been controversial as well. If we go back to March, it hit Billboard's top 100 country, and then Billboard removed it, saying, actually, it's not country. And they got a lot of pushback saying, actually, no, that's just racist. This is a country song. It should be on the country Billboard. And I wonder how much that kind of controversy, perhaps the idea that Lil Nas X is an underdog trying to beat the system, how much could those sorts of things boost the popularity of a song?
That's a tough question, right? What is country? What defines something as a country song? What makes a song country? In our analyses, we really took advantage of the fact that Billboard already classifies certain songs into certain genres. And so what we did is we used the lyrics and we said, okay, are the lyrics of a given song more different from the topics the genre usually sings about? So if it's a country song, but it's singing about different topics than country usually sings about, is it more successful? But in terms of what makes a song as part of a certain genre, a lot of what Billboard is doing in those cases, it's having people listen to it and saying, does this seem like country? Is the artist a country artist? You know, if Billy Ray Cyrus sings a song, people are probably going to say it's a country song just because it has Billy Ray Cyrus on it. Whereas if Madonna sings a song, people are probably going to say it's pop. Now, does that mean that Madonna's song couldn't be a country song? No, but it probably means that Madonna's going to have to do more work to make a song of hers seem like a country song.
That controversy, though, that's what I'm kind of curious about, is this idea that any publicity is good publicity. Could that actually help propel the song to popularity?
Certainly. You know, controversy is a great way to generate word of mouth. We've done a bunch of research showing at least moderate controversy, so not extreme controversy, but at least moderate controversy is a great way to get people talking because everybody has an opinion, right? Some people say, yep, I think this is a country song. Other people say it's not. And then everybody argues about it. A conversation ensues. Other people get involved. People love sharing their opinion. And now this song has gotten a lot more attention than it would otherwise. You know, think about that posting a few years ago about the color of a dress, right? There was that great viral thing about, is the dress this color? Is it that color?
It was blue and black, absolutely.
I don't even remember what it was, but the internet was all talking about it for a whole, you know, week or even 2 weeks. And because people can share their opinions, because they can weigh in, it gives something more attention. So I think that certainly helped this song both be successful and have a longer life than it might have otherwise.
Well, Jonah Berger, that was going to be my next question, because going viral is one thing, but things often go viral and then disappear the next week. Whereas what we're talking about here with Old Town Road is staying at the number one spot on the Billboard Top 100 for 17 weeks, longer than any other song. How different is the formula for getting popular versus staying popular?
It's a good question, and I think the challenge, right, is a lot of the things that make something popular, because it's really flashy and completely different or very controversial, many of those things often don't have a lot of substance. So apologies to the artist who sang, you know, What Does the Fox Say a number of years ago, but, you know, you remember that song, What Does the Fox Say? Do, 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 do.
What does the fox say?
Yeah, you know, that was popular for about a week, and then it kind of disappeared. In part because the song wasn't actually that much fun to listen to, right? Whereas you compare that to something like Old Town Road, you compare that to something like Baby Shark. You compare that to something where when you listen to it, it's also kind of an earworm, right? You can't get rid of it.
These are complete earworms that I have had Old Town Road in my head for 5 straight days. And this is not the first time. There have been, you know, weeks over the past few months where I can't get Old Town Road out of my head.
Yeah, and that's really where I think, you know, hopefully one day the science will be, right? So I find songs fascinating. I love listening to them. But even more, I love thinking about questions like, well, what makes a song an earworm, right? Is it the lyrics? Is it the musical features? Is it both? You know, for the paper we did, Grant and I did, you know, we only looked at lyrics. We just focused on lyrics because there are some natural language processing techniques out there that allow us to measure features of lyrics and look at success. But it'd be interesting to look at the musical features as well and think about, you know, how does the combination of the two aspects make it so that it's not only likable, but extremely memorable.
I want to come back to this idea of remixes of the song. We already heard one remix that involved Billy Ray Cyrus. But if you go on any streaming service, you can find tons of remixes of Old Town Road, including one by a group called Kids Bop, popular with young kids.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I get
these remixes. Are essentially like celebrity endorsements in some ways, but they're also potentially a way to introduce this song to new audiences. And that's kind of a new feature in the music scene. If you go back 20, 30 years, you weren't necessarily getting, within months of a song being created, a dozen different remixes of it. How much has that changed what becomes popular?
The music industry has changed a lot. And as you very nicely laid out, you know, it used to be not all about the song, but heavily about the song. How much did people like the song? Could they pay radio DJs to play the song? But it's really about the song itself. What you see today is songs aren't part of albums. They're released individually at different points in time. Listening to music is partially about the song itself, but it's also partially about being the first person to hear a new cut or a new release of something. Music artists like Nipsey Hussle have been really smart about how they release music, thinking about songs not just as something to listen to, but something as gives you social currency to show that kind of you were there first, and releasing things like limited edition mixtapes. So, you know, artists like Lil Nas X really are fluent in the language of the internet. He's done a great job of adding memes and doing remixes and encouraging others to participate and really making it something where the song kicks off an ongoing conversation that other people can participate in. And this is where we really get, you know, we move from kind of a song to a movement, right? When you think about things going viral, you think about things catching on, you think about individual products, we think about the thing itself. But when these things really catch fire, they build a broader movement. They allow a larger set of people to participate and make that thing their own. We started a project at one point in time that never went anywhere, but kind of look at these individual remixes of songs, right? Where people go make their own version of Old Town Road, you know, in their bathroom or their living room. They dance, you know, to the whatever Gangnam Style dances, and then they upload it online. And whether the ability to kind of participate in these things keeps them alive, right? Because each person does their own version. It's not perfect, but they share it with their friends, and their friends go and do their own version, and then they go back and check with the original song. And now weeks and even months later, that song is still relevant, where it might not be otherwise.
Jonah Berger, your 2013 book, Contagious, of course, has been picked up by a lot of people who want to create something that will become popular. Why would it be important for the rest of us to understand our own reactions to books or music or anything else that we encounter, and what makes us like it or respond to it, and what makes it become a popular phenomenon?
You know, I got started studying this area, not because of social media, but I got started studying rumors and urban legends. So this was the late 90s. I went to college as an undergrad at Stanford, hooked up with a guy there named Chip Heath, who was a professor. And he was interested in, you know, what makes certain rumors and urban legends successful. And at the time, people weren't really interested in that question. Some people were, but not many people. People said, oh, rumors, urban legends, those are things that kids tell one another. Why do those really matter? But what's really interesting is those same principles that drive us to share rumors and urban legends are the same principles that drive us to share fake news, are the same principles that drive us to engage with and share songs and news and other sorts of things as well. And so I think while certainly marketers and companies and organizations want to make their stuff successful, if I'm a music artist, I want to understand what's going to make someone share or engage with my track. Even as an individual, it's really important to understand, well, hey, I'm getting all this stuff shared with me through social media and other channels. Should I be paying attention to it? Does the fact that other people are sharing it mean that it's actually good and worth my attention? How might things like filter bubbles and echo chambers lead me to focus my attention on things that might not be the best for me to learn about or pay attention to? And how can I make sure that I'm learning not only what my friends are paying attention to, but what might be important in the world more generally? As you think about wanting to become sort of an informed population, how do we do that in today's day and age? We don't just flip open a newspaper. Many of us don't even read a physical newspaper anymore. But when we go online, this information is increasingly tailored to what we've liked in the past. And that's good in some ways, right? We're more likely to like what we're reading, but it also focuses down one particular narrow direction that may not be good overall.
Well, Old Town Road certainly got a lot of us out of our bubbles. Jonah Berger is an associate professor of marketing at University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School and author of Contagious, Why Things Catch On. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Up next, the surprisingly long history of Lyme disease. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Lyme disease is named for a town in Connecticut where some of the first human cases of the disease were documented. There used to be a military research lab nearby, and there's long been an idea that Lyme disease was released by the military, either accidentally or maybe even deliberately. That idea has seen a resurgence recently, with Congress ordering the Pentagon to answer once and for all whether or not it engineered ticks to be weapons and then released them. My next guest says, we already know the answer, and it's a resounding no. Lyme disease is not an escaped military weapon. It's a disease that has been around for over a century. Sam Telford is professor of infectious disease and global health at Tufts University, and he recently wrote about the long history of Lyme disease for TheConversation.com. Sam, good to talk with you again.
I'm pleased to be here.
You argue that the military could not possibly be responsible for Lyme disease because it predates any ability to engineer bioweapons by decades. How far back can we trace Lyme disease?
It is possible that Lyme disease, or at least the bacteria that cause Lyme disease, go back before the Ice Ages. population genetics studies, not done by me, but by colleagues at Yale, demonstrate that in North America, you could probably expect to have found them 60,000 years ago.
Wow. Okay. Well, that definitely predates any bioengineering. In more recent history, you, as a graduate student, went looking in museum samples to see if you could find evidence of Lyme disease. What kinds of samples and what did you find?
I don't know about recent history, but for my doctoral work, I worked with David Persing, then at Yale, on museum specimens of ticks and mice. And so we were able to detect using, and this dates me, the then new technology of polymerase chain reaction, to find it in ticks from 1945, eastern end of Long Island, and in mice from 1896 from Cape Cod.
1896. So this is definitely not a new thing in our neck of the woods. But I'm curious, I mean, why would you think that you could find this microbe in preserved specimens, you know, mice and ticks that are that old? I mean, they're that well preserved?
Oh, yeah. Museum collections are a tremendously valuable resource to ask questions like this. And it was the only way I could test the hypothesis that Lyme is actually pretty old and is a system that was present before the Ice Ages all over the globe. And what we saw originally is remnant distribution from the action of the ice sheets. But there's no way to really test that rigorously. But one thing that would be consistent is to find them evidence of infection in animals prior to seeing human cases.
Well, Sam Telford, the story of human infections also goes back further than many of us realize. We tend to think about those first cases in the U.S. in the 70s, but you write that European doctors described cases in the early 20th century.
Yes, the physicians in Europe had long been dealing with aspects of Lyme disease. There are even suggestions that Soviet physicians were seeing it in the 1880s, 1890s, but certainly a well-documented condition, erythema migrans, then known as erythema chronica migrans, the expanding rash that is characteristic for Lyme disease, was described in Sweden in the early 1900s.
When and how was the organism that causes Lyme disease discovered and linked to that rash and the broader disease? I mean, obviously, these descriptions going back to the 1800s, the early 1900s, weren't linked to a microbial cause.
That's correct. There was no hint as to what the causative agent was, although German scientists and Swedish scientists believed that it was bacterial because when antibiotics were made available in the 1950s, they noted that the rash disappeared when the antibiotics were taken by the patients. But it was 1981 when the late Willy Bergdorfer at the Rocky Mountain Laboratories of the National Institutes of Health made a serendipitous discovery that the ticks that he was analyzing, he was expert on Rocky Mountain spotted fever. He was interested in whether these new deer ticks could carry Rocky Mountain spotted fever and found a worm that he had actually seen as a graduate student in Switzerland. And he looked at the ticks more carefully by staining them and looking them under a microscope and found spiral-shaped bacteria that he had worked on as a graduate student back in the late 1940s in Switzerland. And he made that connection because there was this mystery in old Lyme and other places in coastal New England of a Lyme arthritis, and no one knew what the cause was. And he had this aha moment. Oh, well, I worked on these. They're a pathogen. Maybe they're the cause of Lyme arthritis. And he was right.
Sam Telford, you also write that there are other reasons why Lyme disease, even if the timing did work, which it doesn't, but even if the timing did work, that Lyme would be an unlikely or impossible bioweapon. It just doesn't meet the standards of what you would try to develop to be a bioweapon. In what way?
Well, bioweapons were intended as things to be used during warfare. And you would want something that would rapidly incapacitate the enemy. Lyme disease doesn't do that. Yes, you get a flu-like illness a week after being bitten by a tick, a lot of people, you know, simply get a rash. Others get fever and chills and muscle aches. And there are a proportion of people who really are sick as a dog, as we say. But that's not unusual for any infection. There's a spectrum of illness from asymptomatic to heavily symptomatic. Biowarfare would require that it acted fairly uniformly to induce casualties very rapidly. The other side of that coin, bioterrorism, an extension of biowarfare, is to use infection to cause terror. There, you don't even have to cause disease. You just have to imply that there's a cause of disease. Maybe there are people out there who believe that Lyme disease is something to be terrified of, but in neither case, Lyme meets the requirements for a organized use offensively.
Certainly, Lyme disease has caused a great deal of concern, perhaps terror, in the Northeast in recent years. Sam Telford, if we take this broader, global, long-standing history of Lyme, that it's been around for tens of thousands of years all around the globe, and that there were even human cases documented decades before we tend to think of it in the 70s, what did happen in the 70s and 80s, and what has continued to happen over the past few decades, that we now have this situation where Lyme is so prevalent? What changed?
We caused this problem ourselves. There were three main reasons why we saw the emergence of Lyme disease as a public health problem in the eastern U.S. and upper Midwest. And that is now happening across the European continent. But the forests were chopped down when the colonists came. It took 18 cords of wood to heat the average home in New England during a winter time. So the woods disappeared very quickly. It all went to farmland. But with changes in the early part of the 20th century, people went to cities, and the farms were generally abandoned, and the forests regrew. But it's not the same forest that we had when the colonists arrived. It's a very different forest. The equilibrium is very different. The fauna is very different. In fact, even the flora is very different. A third of the species in forests today are invasive. So that was one factor. The second is we suburbanized. So with the advent of people moving to the cities, and then they moved out of the cities into suburbs. So suburbanization and building homes right up in these reforested sites put people in contact with what started to be this imbalance of nature in these new forests. And then finally, the main imbalance in these new forests is that we don't have any of the large predators that would keep animals in check. And so deer have increased dramatically in their numbers over the last 30 years. And it doesn't take a lot of deer to generate an awful lot of ticks. In fact, one of the big questions for me is, why on earth aren't we up to our necks in ticks? There's something that clearly regulates tick populations.
Let's hope so. Sam Telford, you have presented multiple lines of evidence that the military did not release Lyme disease in Connecticut in the 1970s, accidentally or otherwise. But you also write for theconversation.com that you are appalled that Congress would order the Pentagon to answer this question directly. Why? Why not get that answer for those who are still concerned about this possibility? Why not get that answer once and for all?
It's the idle curiosity of a minority. The majority of people would rather see our legislators turn their attention to bigger public health problems. And among those big public health problems is the true epidemic of Lyme disease, to actually do something about it as opposed to just sitting there pointing their fingers and assigning blame. What good does that do?
What would you like to see Congress doing that they haven't been?
There's been a really good argument lately. Jorge Benesch, who sent Willie Burgdorfer the ticks that allowed Burgdorfer to actually discover the agent of Lyme disease, who wrote an article recently that argued that our success with eradicating malaria from the United States, the U.S. had malaria up until the 1940s, maybe even the early 1950s, and they had a national campaign to eradicate malaria in the 1940s and 1950s, and it was very successful because it was nationally directed. And so we may need a nationally directed effort to prevent Lyme disease. Let's prevent tick bites. Let's make the environment safer and focus our efforts that way, a Manhattan Project on prevention.
Sam Telford is professor of infectious disease and global health at Tufts University. He recently wrote about the long history of Lyme disease for theconversation.com. Sam, thanks.
You are very welcome.
And that's our show. Meet us back here next week for more Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.